So thank you for inviting me here tonight. I think this is your last Dharma talk for the year, is that right? So maybe it's a good one to finish off with, how to do good karma. So we'll skip over exams very quickly and say I've got holidays coming up soon, so that's tremendous. So it's a great chance to practice developing good karma. So the topic tonight is how to do good karma. But I guess before we can begin to answer that, we really need to have a think about what karma actually is. You know, get a sense of what it is we're talking about. And then we can work through to the more specific things about, you know, what we can actually do. So I just thought I'd ask for a bit of feedback, and feel free to jump in anyway through the talk and, you know, add your 2 cents worth, as we say, to question or add something extra or disagree if you want to. You're very welcome. That would be interesting. So what is karma? What do you reckon? Any thoughts about that?
Action
with intention is one of the answers that we've got. Action with intention. Yep. Other things? How do people use the word? I mean, how have you heard it used?
Yeah, always heard it being used like some sort of
force. Yeah, force, yeah. Can you put it in a sentence like that? How do people normally say it?
Karma strikes back.
Yeah.
Karma's gonna get you.
Karma's gonna get you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So it's used in all sorts of different ways, isn't it? And you hear it all the time. And maybe it's not used quite so much these days, but certainly in the 60s and the 70s, you know, it was used a lot. And I think it's still used a fair bit. So I think along the way we should think about some of those modern usages and the things you might have heard, or some of the beliefs that you might have yourself about karma, and let's see if they fit into this Buddhist understanding of what karma is. So we'll do a bit of exploration around that. We might look a bit at where it came from originally, or around the time of the Buddha, because it's quite useful to understand the context that it's set in, historical and so forth. And then we can have a bit of a look at what it means for in terms of Buddhist practice or Buddhist thought, and then we'll look maybe at some Buddhist practice and, you know, how we actually make or do good karma. So that's the plan. We'll see how we go. And hopefully won't talk for too long, and then we can have some questions and answers, or questions at least anyway. Hello, welcome. So I guess at a basic level, most of us have a sense that karma is something to do with actions and something about how we live our lives. And so that would be a general sort of understanding of karma, I guess, wouldn't it? And there's a quote from the Majjhima Nikaya where the Buddha's talking to some students and says, "Students, beings are owners of their actions, heirs of their actions. They originate from their actions, are bound to their actions, have actions as their refuge. It is actions that distinguish beings as superior or inferior." And here actions actually means karma or karmas. Students, beings are owners of their actions, heirs of their actions. They inherit the consequences, I guess, of their actions, you could say. They originate from their actions. Beings originate from their actions. They're bound to their actions, have actions as their refuge. And this last sentence, I think, is really important. It is actions that distinguish beings as superior or inferior. So we know from the Majjhima Nikaya, from the Buddha, that it's something about actions, that karma and actions are somewhat similar here. But we also know, as we've just been talking about, that karma in modern sort of language, I guess, the last 20 or 30 years, can mean something like cosmic justice or fate. You know, it's your karma, it was their karma, that sort of thing. And we might well say to somebody, when they say, "Oh, such and such happened, you know, somebody stole my car," and they say, "Well, that's your karma." And somebody from a more traditional Buddhist culture might say, "It must be something bad you did in a past life, you know, and you're reaping your karma now. Your karma has come back to karma strikes back," that sort of thing. One of the issues in saying that, usually gets a fairly bad reaction if you say that. Have you noticed? Have you ever heard that, had that said to you, or heard it said to somebody else, or maybe you've said it? Mostly we don't like that, because it sounds like we're being blamed for something that we did in the past, except maybe it was a past that we can't remember. So it was me, but somebody else, but also me. And it can make us feel a bit guilty as well. And it can it can feel like it's callous. So if there is let's say it's a national disaster, there's a tsunami or something like that, you know, some people might say, well, that's the karma of all those people. They were reborn together and that's their karma, that they'll be suffer hardship and many of them will die. You know, that may or may not be the truth, but certainly the effect on people, generally speaking, of saying that on the whole is to make them feel very bad. Maybe some more traditional Buddhists would find comfort in that. Certainly amongst the Tibetan population, there are quite a number of stories of Tibetans who have been put into prison by Chinese and have been, in some cases, tortured. What got them through that was believing that it was that they were actually paying off past karma, and that in that way they could not necessarily blame the guards, because they thought, well, it's their karma and somehow my karma is mixed in with theirs. And so it really did help them get through. So we should say here that for some people, that understanding is very helpful. But in my experience, for the broad range of people, to say that's your fate or that was their fate, you know, it can feel very much like we're judging people, or just saying, well, really, you know, you did something wrong and now you deserve to suffer. Cosmic justice. So it doesn't come across as being very compassionate usually. One of the other things that we sometimes think, and you know, I work as a bereavement counsellor, so I work in the public health system, and I see families after or people after somebody's died, often with cancer, but from other things as well. And what people often run up headlong against there when a good person dies is struggling with why they've died. Why should a good person die? And we'll struggle for a long time to find reasons that are good enough to explain that good person, that decent person, dying. Because it doesn't seem fair. It doesn't seem like it's cosmic, there's any cosmic justice there. It feels like it's unjust. And people will often ask the question, well, why was it them and why not somebody else who wasn't as good? I used to work at Darlinghurst in the hospital there, and I'd sit in my little counselling room and we'd see across to Green Park near Sacred Heart Hospice. And quite frequently, people I was talking to, they would look out the window and they'd see the people who'd just been to the methadone clinic. They got their methadone and they got their coffees and they were out in the park and really, you know, just having a nice time and not being offensive or anything, but clearly, you know, struggling in their lives. And people would often look at them and say, you know, why'd it have to be my husband or wife or my child or whoever it happens to be, my mother or father? Why couldn't it have been one of them? They're no use to anybody. And as soon as that came out of their mouths, they would feel appalled that they'd said it. But nevertheless, that was a sort of genuine feeling. And what's that about? It's about struggling to find a reason that says why this good person and why not somebody who seems not to have as much use in the world. And in my experience also, most people, and it doesn't matter from what religion or what their background is, they fail to find a reason good enough, a big enough karmic reason, if you like, to make that death, that loss, okay. They may come to accept it or acknowledge it. They may learn how to re-engage with life. But I don't think I've ever found one person who said, yep, that's all okay by me. There's a reason big enough. Quite religious people will say, yes, I have faith, they're in heaven, or they've gone into another rebirth, I've been reincarnated, whatever it happens to be, and I believe they're in a better place. But it's still not enough, because I still miss them. And it doesn't seem fair, especially if it's a child. So this notion that people are inheriting their karma from the past, you know, may be true, but if we hold on to that in a very unexamined way, I'm a good person, my family good people, we do the right things, we should be relatively safe and okay, and life will smile on us, then we usually run headlong into an existential crisis. You know, why is the world like this? And even notions of karma, those notions that, well, I did something, they did something bad in the past, simply aren't sufficient to make that okay. Is that making sense to you so far? It's a very difficult time for people to go through. So we need to investigate this notion of karma a bit more deeply than the idea of fate or something arising from actions in the past. For most of us, I think anyway. So let's go back a little bit further get some sense of where all this came from. So we know that the Buddha, or Siddhartha, grew up in a Brahmin culture. And it wasn't quite the caste system, but it was the sort of precursor of the caste system. And within this culture, and this is really just a thumbnail sketch in a way, the notion of karma was already around. It predated Siddhartha, the Buddha, but it was definitely around when he was growing up and during the time that he then was the Buddha. But karma actually meant something a little bit different. But it shares something of what we would understand as Buddhist practitioners, Buddhist students, about this notion of karma, and that is that it was built around action. Now, we know from that last bit I read from the Majjhima Nikaya that there's something about action, and it was mentioned before, that is involved in karma. And certainly, if you'd been born at that time, you would have known about karma and you would have performed various actions to make good karma. So, for example, the Brahmin class, or the priestly class, would tend to the sacred fires. And interestingly, we can't really talk about it too much tonight, fire is a very strong image that you find through the early suttas, the Pali suttas. It's everywhere. And I think there's a good reason for that. And again, as I said, it's one we can't really explore too much. I think what the Buddha was doing when he spoke about fire was he was taking an absolutely central symbol of Brahmin culture and he was subverting it and turning it around. And this does play into this notion of karma, which I'll get to in a moment. So if you were born at that time, you would have been involved in performing certain duties, and that would have defined what meant by making good karma. You were following the prescribed rituals and performances and so forth. You lived in certain ways, and then you would develop good karma. And you could make merit, and we certainly talk about merit in traditional Buddhism as well. Now, we know from the early suttas that there were lots of wandering ascetics and, you know, people engaging in all sorts of interesting practices and trying to make a good karma, good karma and to make merit. And in a way, the leaving of home and performing these ascetic rituals was also a way of purifying themselves. So these rituals were about purifying oneself to make merit and for a better rebirth. So very similar to Buddhists as well. But it was all about the actions one performed. So let me read you something about some of the ascetic practices that you'll find in the suttas. So this one, you may have already know this one about the dog duty ascetic and the ox duty ascetic. Have you heard about them at all? Okay. I'll read it out to you. But I won't read the whole thing. It's quite long. So this is to give you an example of the sorts of practices people would have been doing if they were ascetics to try and make good karma, and to give a sense of how Buddhism then is different to this. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living in the Kolyan country. There is a town of the Kolyans called Halidavasana. Then Panya, a son of the Kolyans and an ox-duty ascetic, you'll get to know what that is in a moment, and also Senya, a naked dog-duty ascetic, went to the Blessed One and paid homage. When Panya, the ox-duty ascetic, sat down, he asked the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, this naked dog-duty ascetic, Senya," that's his companion, "does what is hard to do. He eats his food when it is thrown on the ground. That dog-duty, or the acting in the way that dogs would act, has long been taken up and practiced by him. What will be his destination? What will be his future course?" So this is an ascetic practice designed to purify, because it's hard, and one does what is hard, to purify oneself, to burn out one's impurities. This burning out, see the notion of burning here again in fire, which was so central to this culture. It's also known as tapas. It's more than just a Spanish food, a delicious Spanish food. It's also this ascetic practices of burning away impurities. Tapas, spelled the same way. So he's practicing these dog duty practices. He's the naked dog duty ascetic. And the Buddha interestingly says to him, "Enough, Panya, let that be, do not ask me that." However, a second and a third time, Panya, the ox-duty ascetic, asked the Blessed One the same question. What will be his destination? What will be his future course? "Well, Panya, since I certainly cannot persuade you when I say, 'Enough, Panya, let that be, do not ask me that,' I shall therefore answer you. Here, Panya, someone develops the dog duty fully and unstintingly. He develops the dog habit fully and unstintingly. he develops the dog mind fully and unstintingly. Having done that, on the dissolution of the body after death, he reappears, guess where, in the company of dogs. But if his view is such as this, by this virtue or duty or asceticism or religious life, I shall become a great god or some lesser god, which is what one wanted to do by purifying oneself, that is wrong view in his case. Now there are two destinations for one with wrong view, I say, hell or the animal womb. So, Panya, if his dog duty is perfected, it will lead him to the company of dogs. If not, it will lead him to hell. So what a choice. If he gets good at his practice, he gets reborn as a dog. If he doesn't get good at his practice, but he holds the wrong view, he gets reborn in one of the hells. And Buddhists have pretty good hells. So not a good destination. And similarly, it goes on. When this was said, Senia, the naked dog duty ascetic, wept and shed tears. And then it goes on where Senya turns around and asks the Buddha, well, what about the ox duty ascetic? What happens to him? And the same sort of answer, you know, he either goes to hell because it's wrong view, he gets reborn as an ox. So not a good destination doing some of these ascetic practices. So they sound a bit odd to us in this day and age, and we tend to smile a bit and go, oh, isn't that funny? But people really believe that they could purify themselves. And even today, if you wander around India or various places, people practice these asceticisms. And even in the West as well, they're still practiced, maybe slightly differently. So the idea is that we're somehow burning away, purifying our karma. And this is a notion that's actually trickled into, burned its way into Buddhism as well, the burning out of impure karma. And you find it in many forms of traditional Buddhism. It'll be up to you to decide whether you think that's valid or not after you've read the suttas and done a bit of study. It's interesting there for me too that the Buddha says not only if they develop the mind but if they get the habit. And here we're starting to get a flavour of karma and what the Buddha means by karma. It's also got something to do with habit. And in a more modern way we could say what you practice you get good at. So if you practice being a dog duty ascetic, guess what? You get good at being a dog duty ascetic. And guess what? You get reborn as a dog or in hell. In a way, if we get into sort of more, we use modern neuroscience language, the brain doesn't really care what we think. If we think it enough and practice it enough, we become that. And that's this notion of habit that the Buddha talked about 2,500 years ago. What we practice, we get good at, for better or worse. So if we're going to practice something, we better be fairly clear that what we're practicing is fairly intelligent and useful. So this notion of habits built into karma as well. So what we practice. So let's move on to Buddhist practice. That's just a little flavour of where this was drawn from. And as I said before, the Buddha took this notion of fire and he turned it on its head, away from this idea of purifying the impurities through ritual sacrifice or ritual actions. And interestingly, the Buddha talked about this fire image as being almost like, well, almost as being a hindrance. And rather than seeing it as purifying, it was seen to be agitated and to be a source of clinging. And the word for clinging is upadana in Pali. And we know from the Wheel of Dependent Origination, which most of you will have seen, there's this sort of funky Tibetan version with the wheel here and Yama, the Lord of Death, hanging over the top with his claws and holding us all in the wheel of samsara. This is the wheel of dependent origination. There's some realms in here as well, and there's, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion in the middle, which the whole thing spins on. It's like the hub of the wheel, the centre of it. And the Buddha's up here, and he's outside of the wheel of samsara. So on link number 8, I think, is upadana, or clinging. And upadana actually means something like fire. What causes us to cling is aversion or craving, you know, desperate wanting or the desire to get rid of aversion, and simply not understanding clearly what's going on, ignorance. So these are the three, they're traditionally called the three poisons, but it's not really an appropriate thing to call them that. That's a bit of a later thing that came up. Greed, hatred and delusion, which I think is better phrased as craving, aversion and ignorance. I think greed is not strong enough, you know, craving, aversion and ignorance. So that's really the hub of this wheel that it spins on. So if we think about one part of that wheel, and this is really important for meditation practice, I'll mention it tonight, but it's really important in terms of understanding karma and how we begin to think about stepping outside of this samsaric wheel of, you know, constantly creating more and more negative karma. There's a particular series of four or five steps in this wheel of dependent origination that are really important. And they go like this. The first one is contact, and I'll explain these in a moment. The second one is feeling. The third one is our old friend craving, followed by clinging, followed by becoming. So I've just mentioned five, and there's a whole lot more than that, but they're five very interesting ones. What does that mean? Well, in a very simple way, what it means is that when we do anything, like I'll pick up this cup of tea and I'll have a mouthful of tea, there's contact. Contact is me tasting the tea. I think this person might be locked out. Would somebody be able to open the door for them? No, here we go. Welcome. So we're talking about the wheel of dependent origination and one particular part that's very important in understanding karma and how to then begin to create, if you like, more positive, more skillful karma. So contact, I had a mouthful of tea and there was contact with my tongue. I knew there was contact, there was heat, and there was knowledge of that. So there's at least three things going on. For example, if I ring the bell, there was contact with the ear, there's the sound, the object that produces the sound, contact with the ear and knowing. So you've got to, you need those few things in order to have an experience, a sense experience. This is contact. From contact, there's a feeling. So when I tasted the tea, there was pleasant feeling. When I hit the bell, that might have been pleasant or unpleasant, I'm not sure. Depends on how hard I hit it and what your associations are. I'll make a point here that it's not inherently pleasant or unpleasant, because what happens next is we start creating a little bit of a story about it and we have all these associations built into that sound. So if you've had some lovely experiences listening to bells, then I'm sure that was quite pleasant. But if that bell was the bell that, you know, called you to church or to temple or something, you really didn't want to go and that was your whole childhood, that could have some quite, oh, I don't really like that sound, and oh, I remember I had to go everywhere, you know. So there's just the contact to start with, you know, and we know there's been contact. There's pleasant or unpleasant. This is vedana in Pali, V-E-D-A-N-A, vedana. And a way of thinking about vedana, because it can be a bit mysterious, it's not yet emotions or stories, it's feeling. If you think about when you like something, you sort of open up to it, you want more of it, or you move towards it, we like it. Or if we don't like it, there's a sense of moving away from it. Oh, I didn't like that harsh sound when Michael hit the bell too loudly. We sort of want to push it away. It's this movement towards or away. It's the feeling, literally the feeling tone of our experience. Contact, feeling tone, craving. I like that. I'd like Michael to ring the bell again. That was great. Why did he stop it? I was really enjoying that. You know, I'd like a bit more of that. This is tanha, we know. Tanha literally means thirst. So we're thirsting for more. Or we're craving to get rid of it. So it's the aversive side of craving, craving to push it away. I wish you'd stop ringing that bell. You know, go back to drinking your tea. That was much more silent. I like that better. And there's a little spectrum there, isn't there, between all of those things happening. So craving. And from craving, we go on to clinging, which is this interesting word, upadana. There's a book called The Mind Like Fire Unbound by Tanjev Tanisaro, the monk. You've got one of his books out there on rebirth. You can find his writings on the website Access to Insight. The Mind Like Fire Unbound. And he talks about the fire image in the Pali Suttas, in early Buddhism. And he says that this word upadana, related to fire and related to clinging, the clinging, and fire was seen to cling onto that which it burned. It clung to its fuel. So we've just had some bushfires. And clearly we're saying these fires come from the bush. That's their fuel. Or we can have an oil fire. We can have all sorts of fires, an electrical fire. So we still sort of follow that notion, don't we? So we understand this notion of upadana. But the idea was the fire clung to its fuel. And if we remove the fuel, like if we burn back beforehand, or we take all the undergrowth away, less likely for a fire, for it to have a bushfire, for example. If we don't leave the oil on the stove at high heat, we're less likely to have an oil fire, so forth and so on. So there's this notion that fire burns dependent on its fuel and it clings to it. And if you remove the fuel, there's nothing for it to cling to. Now, if it does cling, we move to this word becoming, or bhava, B-H-A-V-A, bhava. Bhava means becoming, and we often hear it in the context in the suttas of bhava tanha or vibhava tanha. The desire, tanha we know is craving, it's thirst. So the desire to become or the desire to not become. You know, to be or not to be, as somebody famous once said, sort of echoing the Buddha 2,500 years ago. There's a modern teacher of insight dialogue, Gregory Kramer, and he talks about the desire to be seen or the desire to hide. And that's quite a nice modern sort of glossing of this notion of bhava tanha or vibhava tanha. And just on that, think about fame. Fame is the big new thing, isn't it? Famous for being famous. You know, because somehow you got yourself on television, you know, perhaps with very little talent or just because of luck. You know, fame is the new modern coin. And what's that but a desire to be seen? So that's a fire. That's the fire of fame. And it burns on adulation, being seen. And the more people that can see us, the more fuel we put on, guess what? The bigger the fire. What we practice, we get good at. We get addicted to being seen. And I always feel for those celebrities who have been famous for whatever and their fame disappears and they spend all their time trying to regain that fame. It's like they almost cease to be themselves, so dependent on people looking back at them in an admiring sort of way to have an identity. So if we cling to whatever the fuel is, greed, hatred and delusion usually, we will become certain sorts of people. And we will get very good at clinging to or becoming or manifesting greed, hatred and delusion, because what we practice we get good at. So what we want is to remove the fuel for the fire and to start reversing this process of ignorance, really. We need to see this process. So the wheel of dependent origination is very useful in terms of seeing the process that then leads into us creating really unskillful, unwholesome, doing unwholesome actions and creating, if you like, negative karma. So if we think about that wheel of dependent origination, it starts to hint at one of the things that was said first off just before, that not only are we talking about actions that are performed, we're talking about what underlies the actions. We're talking about the motivations or the intentions that underlie the actions. Now, if we don't know what our intentions are or our motivations are, or if our intentions or motivations are simply fueled by habit that we haven't seen, then we're condemned to live in the same way. Condemned to live in the same way because we don't see clearly what's going on. So right at the heart of this notion of skillful karma and living skillfully is to begin to know ourselves more clearly, to see more clearly into what our motivations and intentions are, the things that fuel our actions, because it's our motivations, our intentions, our desires and so forth that fuel our actions. So we need to begin to see the fuel on which our actions are built. So you see, this idea of fuel is very important here. So this word upadana is very important. Just an important point I want to make about this wheel of dependent origination. Because we see it going in a circle like this and we see it cycle around, sometimes we think it's linear. This leads to this, leads to this, leads to this. And whilst that's at least partly true, because there is that implication, we really need to understand that if we hold just that view, it's not a complete view of dependent origination. If that was the case, then we would believe that the future is determined. because one thing necessarily leads to another, necessarily leads to another. There'd be nowhere to intervene in that, would there? We'd just be the running on the wheel. And we'd be back to where the Brahmins were of just doing, or that whole society were, of just doing the actions that had already been decided you should do, that you should perform. And if you do them well, then you might get a better rebirth. So it's pretty much you're born as you are, do what you're meant to do, and with some sort of faith you'll be reborn. And this is not a Buddhist understanding. This is very deterministic, isn't it? There's a notion of fate in this. A way of thinking about the wheel of dependent origination is as the wheel of co-dependent origination. So I talked about the bell before. Now for us to experience that sound, there has to be a bell and a sound produced by it. There has to be an ear and there has to be the ability to know it. In that one moment of contact, patsa, contact, there has to be a number of things co-dependently happening for me to be able to know there's a bell. So we need to understand that this wheel of dependent origination is not something that it's about fate. We can actually intervene. There's room for creativity. In fact, I'll tell you what the Buddha said about this. He said, when those ascetics and Brahmins hold such a view of this, and this is the view, whatever a person experiences, whether it is pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, all that is caused by what is done in the past. In other words, this linear view that what I did in the past leads to what I'm going to be in the future. The Buddha says, and this is really interesting, they overshoot what one knows by oneself. They overshoot what one knows by oneself. And they overshoot what is considered to be true in the world. Therefore, I say that this is wrong on the part of those ascetics and Brahmins. So we should be really clear that this notion that karma comes from the past and pushes us to the future is not entirely accurate, after all. So karma is more than just ritualized action. It's more than just burning away impurities. And what makes it different is this notion of intention, as was said right at the start, volition, chetana, C-E-T-A-N-A, chetana, intention. So there's a verse that actually really sums up this very nicely, and it's from the Dhammapada, and I think nearly all of you here will know it. It goes like this. Experiences are preceded by mind. And mind here is the nama, nama, the knower. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. Now, the Buddha doesn't say here that if you do something good, good things will happen out there in the world necessarily. I mean, it's far more likely to be true, but he doesn't fall into that deterministic trap of saying, do good here and good will certainly happen there. You know, he actually says the world is far more complex than that. But what we can know is that our intentions influence our actions, and that if we're working, keeping in mind our values, then our actions are likely to follow. And at least at an inner level, we can feel some degree of calmness and peace that we are walking in a way and acting in a way that is conducive to the letting go of suffering. Suffering being produced by ignorance, craving and aversion. And the Buddha many times said, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. A very simple message. So really that's all we're on about, teaching suffering, learning about suffering and the end of suffering. To learn about suffering, this is what we don't like doing, we need to see how it comes up. But then once we know that, we can start to see this, you know, reverse, if you like, the cycle of dependent origination. We don't have to be pushed along by it anymore. What this particular verse is talking about is two things, actually. It's talking about intention, or actions and intentions, but it's also talking about the fruit of those actions, and that's technically karma vipaka. So when people, coming back right to where we started at the start of this talk, when people talk about karma very often, they're talking technically about what we would call karma vipaka, the fruit of karma, what happens. So there's karma, intentional action, and what happens after that, the fruit of karma. So as I was saying, we need to open up and to understand who we are and what's driving us. We need to look clearly into ourselves, and that's nothing but meditation practice. And I've got a poem that actually talks about this process. It's not about meditation, but I think it says something about meditation. And it's called Autobiography in 5 Short Chapters. See if you can relate to this at all. Here we go. Autobiography in 5 Short Chapters. I walk down the street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost. I am helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. Chapter 2. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place, but it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it is there. I still fall in. It's a habit. But my eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. And chapter 5. I walk down another street. So isn't that interesting? It's just the process we've been talking about, isn't it? It's the process of, first of all, not even knowing what's going on and continually stepping in the same hole. How many times have we done that in life? Keep doing the same thing with, oh, that's right, I meant not to do that, you know, and I've done it again. Not my fault. Somebody else caused me to do this. It was my parents' fault. I know it was, you know. They caused me to be born. I didn't ask to be born. That's what we often say when we're 12 or 13, you know. Must be their fault. And then, you know, we walk down the same street. We do the same thing. And we start to see what's going on. We go, oh, I can't believe I'm here again. But we still think, well, it's got nothing to do with me. It's society. It's the university. Why have they put the exams on at this time? If this is ridiculous or, you know, whatever it happens to be. Not my fault. I didn't fail because of my fault. It was the university, you know, whatever. Chapter 3, I walk down the same street. I still fall in, but this time we see it's a habit. Remember, we're talking about habits of mind, what we practice, we get good at. This process of understanding what karma means is uncovering habits, you know, uncovering just habitual motivations, habitual intentions, seeing them clearly. But we start to know where we are. We start to see how it's working, this wheel that is working, you know, how samsara actually works. And the important, we say, it has got something to do with me here. Maybe I'm involved in this. As we're standing in the hole, we must be involved in some sort of way. Chapter 4, when she says, I walk down the same street. And this time, because we know we're primed, we can start to see what's going on. We don't have to step in the hole again. We don't have to do the same thing. We start to understand something more about ourselves and our motivations. And we can start working with that. And chapter 5, I walk down another street. So it all begins with beginning to see that something's not working right. It's interesting with this wheel that, you know, turns, this wheel of samsara. It's a bit like it turns on a hub that doesn't quite fit. You know, it something just doesn't feel right sometimes, and that's when we know we've got to start investigating. We can't pretend we're not involved there. So in developing, you know, or doing, if you like, good karma, first of all, we need to start to unpack the process. And meditation is a part of that, but it's not the only part. We're talking about it now. We're not necessarily meditating. So we can start to unpack it, you know, more cognitively for ourselves to look at what Buddhism actually is and also what it isn't. So then we need to start cultivating what's skillful actions, kusala, skillful actions. To do that, we need to understand or to develop a value system that we believe in. If we don't understand what our values are and we don't have motivation to practice those values or living according to those values, we'll simply keep doing the same thing. So we need to investigate what we really believe in, what we really, really want out of life, what really means something to us. And we want to act wholesomely, develop skillful actions. But it's interesting, the Buddha actually says the first step in that is not really so much developing skillful actions as it is avoiding doing the unskillful ones. Very pragmatic. And there's a little line in one of the books out there that goes, and you will have heard this as well, avoid evil, do good, purify the mind. Have you heard that? Avoid evil, do good, purify the mind. And this is a great formula, because we're here tonight to talk about how to do or make good karma, cultivate good karma. There's your formula. Avoid evil. Well, let's just start there. Avoid the unskillful, perhaps, is how we would translate it these days. Purify the mind, and in between, do good. There's a very interesting piece of research that was done years ago, and I just can't remember the researcher's name, but it's very famous, and some of you will have heard of it, I'm sure. It was with young children, around five or four, and they were brought into a room, and they were told, look, you're going to have to sit here for 5 to 10 minutes, I forget the length of time, but it wasn't too long, and there's a couple of cookies there. So it's American. And if you can resist eating them, you can have both the cookies. But if you can have one now, but I'm going to go out and we'll see what happens. So there's a cookie there, you resist it, I'll give you the other cookie as well. Two cookies, fantastic, makes sense, doesn't it? So very interesting, they'd watch the kids through the mirror, and they'd watch what they did. And a lot of the kids end up taking the cookie because they just couldn't, oh, there it is, I can't resist it, you know, yum. And the idea there was another one coming didn't, you know, they just couldn't, they tried and couldn't. But there were a number of children who were actually able to resist the cookie. And it's very interesting to hear how they did that. They shared a strategy, and they're all Buddhists, but they didn't know it. What they did was they avoided the unskillful or the unwholesome. That is, they distracted themselves. They got under the chair and played, or they looked, or they sang to themselves, whatever. They didn't go where the danger was, the cookie. Isn't that interesting? It's so simple, and yet it's such a guideline. It fits so simply into what the Buddha's talking about here, because we tend to think, oh, avoid evil. Oh, my gosh, what does that mean? Oh, it's such a big thing. But it's actually very simple. Now, this is completely trivial, and it's not really about skillful actions in terms of values, but let's say you're trying to lose some weight, or you know, you've got diabetes and you can't eat sweet things. No patting people on the back. Unskillful. You know, if you walk down the aisle in the supermarket that has all the ice creams, you know, forget it. That's the cookie aisle for you, isn't it? You're done for. You know, and you're like those five-year-old kids where you go, you know, once you're in the aisle, it's very hard to get out of it, isn't it, without getting some ice cream. And once it's in your freezer, forget it. Especially if you're a male, you're done for. You know, it's got to come out all the time till you finish it. And I think for women, the equivalent would be chocolate. I don't know what it is about chocolate. They say it mimics the feeling of love, being in love. So, but whatever your particular addiction might be, and it doesn't have to be food, clearly. You know, it might be members of the opposite sex. It might be sleeping. It might be, you know, whatever it is. We need to learn how to not be where the danger is in many ways. And it's not the whole answer, but it's, as the Buddha said all these years ago, 2,500 years ago, it's the beginning of skillful practice, is avoiding the unwholesome. Such a simple thing. Don't be where the danger is. But to do that, we need to know what the danger is. We need to have looked and understood and thought and investigated what our values are, things that are important to us. And that's actually something that the Buddha would say, I think, that each person has to work out for themselves. Now, he gave some guidelines about all of this. But in many places in the suttas, he said to people, I will teach you the world. That's a big statement, isn't it? I will teach you the world. It's a huge statement. It sounds arrogant, doesn't it? And then he said, the world is this fathom-long body. In other words, the world you need to investigate is you. This fathom, it's what, 6 feet or something, is you. That's the world you need to investigate. So avoiding the unwholesome, investigating the world that is you. You know, knowing what punches your buttons and then stepping back from that. You know, maybe it's computer games, I don't know what it is. Okay, so I won't go on too much longer. The other way of then cultivating the good clearly is in meditation practice, cultivating what's skillful. And that's this cycle of dependent origination, just in terms of tonight's talk anyway. Understanding when it is we're becoming, particularly if we're becoming something we don't want to become. If we're being born into each moment, being a person we don't want to be, we need to notice that. And we need to see how that occurs. And usually you'll notice there's been a cycle. There's been contact, there's been a feeling, a sensation, a whole lot of emotions come up, a lot of thoughts, a whole lot of thought stories, usually about me, in your case about you. And then as we get involved in that, we start craving to have more of a good feeling, or crave to get rid of bad feelings, you know, good stories about myself, get rid of the bad stories about myself. And then we're into clinging and wanting more and more and more, or pushing away, pushing away, pushing away. And we're being born each time we do that. Meditation practice is possibly the best way, it's the most subtle way of seeing that process. And you can see it at more and more refined levels. And it's really, I personally think, in terms of insight practice, Vipassana practice, it's really a key practice to investigate, particularly in terms of understanding how karma arises. And finally, the other way of doing or cultivating good karma is clearly in everyday life. Just as we are here now coming to a talk and reflecting on the Dhamma. And it doesn't really matter what I say. It's more about what you're taking on board and what you think. You know, you're free to forget everything I said. But if something's resonated, then you should write that down and go and ponder it. And maybe practice, think how you can practice that in everyday life. And the Buddha, in terms of the Eightfold Path, was very clear that everyday life and friends are very important. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. We know that's, in fact, the heart of the Noble Eightfold Path. Right speech, right action, wholesome action, right livelihood, wholesome livelihood, skillful livelihood. And it can get very complex. We can get into all sorts of rules about what's right and what's wrong. But at the heart of all of that is this notion of not harming. Not harming ourselves and not harming others. And this is really the heart of the Buddha's practice. And remember when Ananda said to the Buddha, oh, we need to let... He didn't say this to the Buddha, but we need to let somebody in. Oh, here we go. Great. Welcome back. It should be easier to come and hear the Dharma, shouldn't it, really? We shouldn't have doors locked. Do you remember when Ananda said to the Buddha that friendship was a part of the holy life? And the Buddha said, don't say it like that, Ananda. Good friends are the whole of the holy life. Isn't that interesting? Good friends are the whole of the holy life. And to be holy, to practice the holy life, is to be skillful. And it doesn't mean, you know, you have to have a monk sitting next to you. It means your friends here, the people that are interested in the Dhamma, these are your Dhamma friends. And these are friends who will, you know, help support us in difficult times. They're also friends who will point out when they think we're actually going down the wrong path. And that's a much more difficult thing to do. And it requires a lot of skill. So bear in mind, the Buddha said to Ananda, good friendship, wise friendship, is the whole of the holy life. Because it's only in these relationships that we tend to practice the Dhamma. Practice becoming more skillful. I want to finish with a quote from a woman called Annie Dillard. I don't know that she's particularly Buddhist, but I think this is a great take-home message in terms of our lives and karma. So we tend to think of karma and our lives. We get the big picture and we think, oh, our lives and karma, it's almost a bit too big. And I've been trying to bring it down to very simple things like the cookies or the ice cream and so forth. But a couple of things that she says here, reflections more on our lives and how we live our lives. She says, how we spend our days is, of course, how we spend our lives. How we spend our days is how we spend our lives. What we do this hour and that one is what we are doing. And she goes on to say, and this is fantastic, there is no shortage of good days. It is good lives that are hard to come by. It is good lives that are hard to come by. So what we do right now is actually what really matters. And it's that accumulation of right nows that make up our lives, and it's what makes the difference between a good life or a problematic life. And if you believe in rebirth, clearly there is some extra incentive for you there as well, because we want to purify ourselves in a Buddhist sense, cultivate skillful actions and skillful ways of being in the world. That requires good friends, hopefully a bit of a meditation practice if you can, and reflecting on the things we've talked about this evening. So how we spend our days is, of course, how we spend our lives. There is no shortage of good days. It's not really about good days. It is good lives that are hard to come by. So we can have some time now for, you know, a bit of feedback, questions, answers and so forth. But before we finish, say, I wish you all a good life. This is really the key thing, isn't it? A good life. And you have such a great say in that, no matter the circumstances. And this is the great message of this Buddhist notion of karma. that it's not just about fate or cosmic justice. It's not just about the actions you perform. It's about something to do with what's going on inside for you and how that manifests itself in the world. That's really important. And you have some say over that. So, you know, it's not a linear going forward just because of what's happened in the past. There is all this stuff happening in the present moment. That's where we get to have input in the present moment. In fact, it's only ever the place we get to have input. So it's a very positive sort of approach to life. And it puts the individual, the world here and here and here and here and each of you, right at the centre. So any thoughts on that or clarifications needed? Questions? Yeah.
Oh, okay, this is related to me. So last semester I got good lecturer and I got better marks.
Yes, yep.
So this semester I got lousy lecturer.
Ah, yes, yes,
and
yes.
I got worse marks.
Yes, yeah.
So is this the lecturer mistake, the faculty mistake, or my mistake?
Let me see if I can find something here from one of the sutras rather than coming back it with my own language. I wonder if I put it in. Where is it? Okay, I had a quote from the Buddha which I'm not sure I can find. Just give me 1 second, I'll see if I can find it for you. Okay, there's a sutta which I don't know that I've actually copied in here. When the Buddha read out that, when I read that, that sutta from the Buddha about when those ascetics and Brahmins hold a view that whatever a person experiences, it's all caused by the past, they overshoot the mark. The Buddha goes on in that very sutta to say that other influences like the environment and physical illness and so forth and so on also play a part in karma. So to answer your question from that, it's all those influences. It is the rotten lecturer, and certainly, you know, we can't pretend the world doesn't throw up difficulties, and it does have an effect on us, of course it does. We also have some say over how we study and how we relate to that lecturer and what we do about it. Maybe very little, maybe a lot. So we have some input into that as well. In some situations we have less input. We can't adjust the outside world so much, and we have to adjust the inside world, as it were. But the Buddha actually said that it's all those things that have an effect. And it's hard to slice it and dice it and saying, oh, well, the lecture was 70% of what went wrong, and, you know, you were 20% and there was a 10% unknown or whatever, you know, variable, miscellaneous. So it's all of those things, really. And what we do with it, either within ourselves or out in the world, is actually sometimes the only bit we have a say over, you know. And yes, that's true. Sometimes the world is like that. And it's one of the reasons why in early Buddhism, certainly the world wasn't seen as a perfect place, and it wasn't seen as a desirable rebirth, a place to be reborn. It's better than hell, and possibly better than some of the god realms, because there's enough pain here to motivate us, like rotten lecturers, that'll motivate you to, you know, to do better or to, you know, change course or whatever it happens to be. But actually it's not seen as the most desirable place. Nibbana, the blowing out of the flame, the cooling of the flame, so there's the flame image again, that seemed to be the most desirable thing in this very life. It's not annihilation. The flame, when it doesn't have fuel to burn on, we can't find out where it is. It's unlocatable. So when people come up, sorry, I'm going a bit off track here, but when people come up to the Buddha and say, you know, are you a man, are you a god, or those sorts of things, he says, I'm the Tathagata, the one who's gone such or thus. In fact, you can't find me anywhere. And it's funny, you're standing right in front of them. But actually, any notion of a self that's grasped onto a me has been extinguished, if you like. There's no fuel for that delusion to burn on anymore. And so this is seen to be the ultimate refuge, actually. So, you know, the rotten lecturer might spur you on to give you the fuel to develop some skillful karma to find a safer refuge. Is that answering your question, speaking to what you're saying? It's complex, and the Buddha said it was complex. Yeah, there's no easy answers with this one, except to aim to understand this letting go of suffering and extinguishing some of the fuel, you know, and then there's a calmness. And it does cause agitation, doesn't it, when we're, you know, we want to do well and we can't do well and there's a tension around it and agitation. There's the flame burning again, you know. Yeah. And we need to see that, actually. Yeah.
What are your thoughts on, you mentioned the simplistic deterministic
view. Yes, yeah.
Do you think that sort of thinking entrenches hierarchical societies, entrenches things like the caste system, and on an individual level it prevents people and in turn prevents society from making improvement, being better, to being
yes,
because this is my fate.
Yeah, that's right. So just to repeat that back and see if I've got it right, does this sort of deterministic linear view of causality, cause and effect, as understood in early forms of karma, does it then lead to a stratified or hierarchical society where people are somewhat stuck within certain layers of society and discourage them from perhaps being more creative or addressing issues that come up and I don't want to say evolving, that's not quite the right word, but moving outside of or changing maybe a system which isn't okay perhaps, or which is painful, something like that?
Yeah.
I agree with you.
Well, and in turn it has, certainly within our region, within Asia, has created certain types of cultures which have inherent weaknesses.
Look, I think, you know, to come back to what I was saying just before, that, you know, the Buddha, I don't think, would see this world as ideal in any way, and there's no ideal system. The system he came up with was almost like a republic, but if you look at the monks and nuns, it was very much, to some extent, non-hierarchical. In fact, he refused to name a leader after him. He said, look, if you think if you've got what it takes, step up. But it wasn't really about making it stratified in that way. It was meant to be a collection of good friends, supporting friends. So, look, I do agree with you, and I think that you know, history bears that out, that looking at our society and ourselves in a fairly deterministic way, it can give a sense of relief because it's like, well, that's the way the world's meant to be, and I just do my duty, and then, you know, presumably after I die, I'll either have a better rebirth or I'll go to heaven because I've done the right thing according to the way things are set up. And that's a very traditional view. So there can be very much, there's a lot of relief in that. And to say to people, oh, look, you can intervene in this, you don't have to be that sort of person, it can cause a lot of confusion, but it can cause a lot of angst and difficulty because there's a sense of, oh, my God, that's too hard. Choice is stressful, you know. And so we think choice is a wonderful thing, but choice brings stress as well. So sometimes to have life mapped out for you or to have certain things you have to do saves you from stress. So to go back to my profession, bereavement counselling, when somebody, say a partner, dies, you could, and I would never say this, but it's like you experience some freedom. People aren't usually very happy about that sort of freedom because, in fact, most of us want to be in a situation we're used to and comfortable in. And when we're thrust into another situation where a lot of the boundaries are removed, it can be terrifying. And we just want to go back to where we were, you know. So choice and freedom needs to be held very lightly, I think, and this is the notion of Buddhist practice, that we uncover what it means to be free incrementally and slowly. You know, perhaps if somebody was to drop us into some sort of advanced meditative state, we'd probably freak out. You know, we would feel less bounded, less like a me, and it would be very scary to drop in there straight away. More like a psychotic breakdown than a breakthrough. So, yeah. So sometimes we do actually, there is a benefit to those stratified ways of being. But clearly there's a shadow side from our perspective as well, and that is that one isn't encouraged to take responsibility for one's life as an individual. So, and of course there are disadvantages with that in the West, and we see that it's a hyper-individualised society, and there are clearly issues with that. You know, the causes of the global financial crisis are probably good to bear in mind there. You know, hyper-individualised greed. You know, less notion of society and much more focus on the self. So yeah, I would agree with what you're saying.
It just seems that notion of compassion. It's totally out of sync.
Throw it out there.
If you have such a simplistic or
deterministic. Yeah, I'm not sure that a deterministic view or a worldview that's much more settled is antithetical to compassion, that it stops compassion from arising. It just arises in a different context, I think, that's all. It's hard to think outside of our own mindset, and so, you know, we need to pause a bit looking at other societies and bear in mind that, you know, they all have ideas about what's good and bad, and there's always room for compassion to arise. For we normally, as human beings, we're social mammals, you know, it's a team game, and we do tend naturally to have a sense of empathy and therefore compassion for others if we can feel their suffering. The shadow side of stratified societies, there's usually tribal or communal, is that its sense of empathy and compassion is very strong within the tribe and tends to have very strong divisions outside of the tribe, or it can do. Shadow side. Yeah, it's interesting. Thank you. Now, the Buddha didn't say any of that last stuff. That was me, so feel free to disagree. I take ownership of anything that was said unskillfully there. Any other questions or things you'd like to ask?
Yeah. We talk about karma as intentions and actions that we do,
yeah.
That we are the heirs of that.
Yeah,
karma.
Yeah.
So that delves into the self, I guess. So how do we link karma and anatta?
Yeah, that's a very deep question. How do we link self and not self, or karma with not self? We have real trouble with that because we just naturally imagine there's a me, a little me in here, like a little man or woman on the inside that's really me. We usually, it feels like me looking out through my eyes and like you looking out through your eyes, doesn't it? We're very attached to that feeling of me, your little person inside or whatever it is. And we often think me is consciousness. That's what many religions believe. You know, many people believe that. Even if they haven't thought about it, that's what it boils down to, really. To understand, my teacher in Burma said, you know, to talk about not self is very difficult, but to understand it in meditation, then it becomes very straightforward. It is a complex area, but part of the issue is that we imagine there's a self on the inside, and it's a bit hard to get beyond that concept. And the Buddha certainly wasn't saying we don't exist or that it's all illusory. I don't read any of that in the early suttas at all. He didn't say it's all illusory. He said there's some, you know, there's some real hard-edged reality to where we're at. Learn from it. But there's this notion of a self where we go too far, where we think we own certain things, we can control certain things, and in fact that's not true. You know, we can't stop ourselves from aging as much as we'd like. I'm getting grey hair, you know, and I can't stop that from happening. I died, I suppose, but it's still getting grey hair. I'm just disguising it, you know. These are things we don't like to see because they prove to us that we're not in control in the way we'd like to be. So in fact, whether you think there's a self or not, karma still operates. And in a way, the meditation practice reveals that. We sort of see this process as an impersonal process. This stuff just happens and we attach yourself onto it. So when you're in deeper meditation, more subtle meditation, you'll see a contact happen, you'll see there's a little feeling that arises, pleasant or unpleasant, you'll see the beginnings of moving towards it, wanting a bit more and moving away, the sense of then clinging on to what's coming up from there and so forth. And we see how the self is born. But at the very point of contact and feeling, there's just a process and we come to see that more clearly. So a way of understanding not self, and this is a term that I've heard used in Burma, is impersonal process. Impersonal process. Process is still there. Nothing changes in a way. You don't disappear like that if you have an experience of nibbana. But you see more clearly into the way that all this process is constituted in this co-arising dependent origination. We're just this compilation of stuff that happens together at the same time, and stuff arises, you know. And we have intention, so that intention and values that we cultivate and so forth, we can have input into that. So the language is difficult here because I just said we can have input into that, because that sounds like a self, a Michael in here that would have input into that. It's sort of true because my intention doesn't disappear. Well, I just become clear that of about what this process is. So karma still exists whether you think there's a self or not. It's just a matter of how much negative karma that you then, as it were, practice as opposed to skillful. Now, there is skillful karma, and skillful karma is that karma that leads to nibbana, to the cessation of suffering. So karma is not necessarily a bad thing. We shouldn't think it's a bad thing. It's skillful or unskillful. And we want to understand what skillful is, wholesome, and then we just practice that. That's what we do. And part of that means understanding ourselves, the process of self, more clearly at all levels. And so, you know, it's because there's a fluid process that karma can arise. You know, if there's no change, then if there's a little me inside here that was a soul and was just looking on all the time, that bit would be unaffected by anything. And all this stuff would be a waste of time. Because then, and so would life really, because then we die and the little soul would pop out however it does and drift off like a little pearl down into the next body or whatever, next little baby that's being born. Same thing. What's the point of that? That seems a bit pointless, doesn't it? I don't know. So maybe there is a little pearl inside. I've never found one. But if you find one, ring me up and let me know. Okay? I don't think you'll find one. And meditation reveals very clearly that there's just this whole process going on. As far as this is the world we can know, and as far as we can know this world of self, this is what we see. You know. So is that okay? Impersonal process. Yeah. We've got an arm over here. Yeah.
Me first. Oh, okay. In one of the previous talks, one of the speakers said, enlightened beings like the Buddha, they don't generate karma. What does that mean by that?
Yeah, I think that's a very difficult thing to understand, I think, and I want to be careful. I'm not the Buddha, and I'm probably not enlightened, but, you know, if I look enlightened, you tell me, and I'd be quite happy to hear it. But my understanding of this is that karma isn't being accumulated, is a better way of putting it, a more skillful way of putting it. So what helps us accumulate unskillful karma is believing there's a me in here, and we get caught up with the notion of me and I want and I can do this and I don't like that. We can see straight away we're contracting around a sense of self. Well, if enlightened beings have got rid of all this misunderstanding, ignorance, there can't be any of that sort of karma accumulated. In fact, whatever happens, happens and just passes away. There is no self, no sense of self, no misunderstanding to which any of this can stick. There's no clinging. There's no fuel. And so in that sense, karma can't accumulate, if that makes sense. But there's still intentional action. I think the Buddha certainly had intentional action. So in that sense, there is karma. But this accumulation of, at the very least, of unskillful, ignorant karma, it simply can't happen because there's no misconceptions anymore. It's been seen through. And that's really another way of thinking about nibbana. And that is the cessation of suffering because, you know, we understand clearly what everything's like. And we can have little, almost nibbanic moments, can't we, where we have insight into, you know, this fact that we're more open as beings than we thought we were. Look at when you're frightened next time, anxious, you're going to have a sense of contraction around a sense of me, you know. And when you're feeling great, it's much more open, isn't it? And when you're the Buddha, imagine the openness there. Incredible. You know, where can anything get stuck? There's nowhere for it to get stuck. Yeah. So that's my understanding anyway. Yeah. When you become enlightened, you come back and tell me, okay? That would be fantastic. Yeah. I hope you do. Was there another question here?
Yeah. What kind of mindset should we have when we want to do good karma?
Yeah. It's a very reasonable thing to say you want to practice skillful intentions and intentional actions so that you're cultivating that and becoming that person the more you practice. You know, how we spend our days is how we spend our lives, you know. So it's very reasonable to think that I want to cultivate good karma. We need to be a little bit careful there about the I in the centre of that sentence, in the centre of that idea. Because if we think we're going to accumulate in the sense of making merit, that I will get this and somehow, you know, I can hang on to it, then we are actually causing far more difficulties for ourselves. You know, in a way, nobody gets good merit. Where could it stick? If there's really fundamentally just a process, where can the merit stick? The merit, if you like, is through the eradication of ignorance, the arising of wisdom. That's the real merit, isn't it? You know, so I think the other very practical thing, motivation we can bring is an act of generosity. so that may I practice good deeds, may I think clearly and skillfully and understand myself more deeply, so that I can, at the very least, cause less suffering in the world, but maybe also cultivate wisdom and non-harm, gentleness, goodness, kindness in the world. This is a great motivation, because it's not just about me. It's about wanting to share the merits, if you want to put it in traditional language. It's not just about, I want to get this. Even when we say that, I want to get it, there's already this sense of contraction, is that I want to pull it in around me and pack myself and make myself more solid, you know. And often that's what we want to do. I want a better suit so I look better, and more money and a better car and fame and all these things. And, you know, we get stuck into place. And then when we lose some of those things or get a sense that we can't hang on to them, we become terrified. And if that's happening, then we know we're practicing in the wrong way. But if we're practicing with the idea of generosity, knowing that we're going to fail and we pick ourselves up and start again, then this is a great motivation. You know, but we need to be generous to ourselves too, as well as to other people. So we need to practice loving kindness for ourselves and for others. The fantastic motivations, the divine abidings, the Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, compassion, you know, empathy and equanimity. These are great motivations that are not about a self. And we could say they're developing skillful karma. They're skillful intentions, and actions should follow from that. Is that speaking to what you're asking?
Yeah.
Yeah. But we're pretty safe. If we keep the divine abidings in mind, then we're pretty safe. It's a sense of releasing this grasping onto me, how I look and how much money I've got and what career I've got. It's not that those things aren't important in everyday life, but if we become obsessed by those, then we're really walking down the wrong path. Yeah. I guess we should finish up soon, really. That's been a fairly lengthy talk. So look, my hope is that, you know, you do have good lives, and that you know, how you spend your days is great, and that it has a really wonderful impact on the rest of your lives. I think the fact that you're here tonight, not to hear me particularly, but because you're interested in the Dharma, I think there's already a great start for you as well. And so if you trust that start, then I'm sure that will carry you through in the same way. Be prepared to make mistakes as well, because that's how we learn, isn't it? And you look at the Buddha's life, even he made, if you like, mistakes. There was a whole learning process before he was awakened. So, you know, we also go through this learning process. So to see this as a process of learning, of opening up and being free, is a fantastic way of looking at our lives, I think. Okay, thank you.